This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a hard fact of life that life can be hard. That might sound like bad news, but the good news is that therapy works, and BetterHelp can help you find a therapist to do what you need to do to stay on track. Therapy is whatever you want it to be. Maybe you're not feeling motivated right now and like some tools to help, or maybe you're feeling insecure in relationships or at work. Whatever you need, BetterHelp can help. I use therapy from time to time to help me sort through challenges, emotions, or just to ensure that I'm on track for the things that are important. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 24 hours. Join the millions of people who are seeing what online therapy is really about. And special offer to Man God Law listeners, you can get 10% off your first month of professional therapy at BetterHelp.com/ManGodLaw. That's better, HELP.com/ManGodLaw. Thanks again to BetterHelp for sponsoring this episode.
Dylan was a revolutionary, man. The way that Elvis freed your body, Bob freed your mind.
This is Bob Dylan, about man and God and law. That is Joni Mitchell, Bob Dylan, and Van Morrison singing Bob Dylan's I Shall Be Raised. That's Joni Mitchell taking the piss out of Dylan while she does it, and Van nearly eating the mic. Dylan looks a touch agitated, kind of pacing the stage, playing the guitar, and Joni seems like she's just tickled pink to be singing, dancing the boho dance in and around Dylan's incredible guitarist, Larry Campbell, and messing with Dylan's hymn. Honestly, if I had to choose three artists, and only three formative artists, if I had three musical wishes, if there were only three poetic champion composers, these might be my three. And if there were two, and maybe there are, it would be Joni Mitchell and Bob Dylan. Now there's B.B. King and Richard Thompson and Aretha Franklin, Elvis Costello and Paul Simon. To the ranking of the great, there really is no end. Right there, far from their best on a baggage tour that did the best that it could when they were doing far from the best that they could, I still cannot imagine life without them. How history will treat these artists is already creeping up on us. Van Morrison seems to have gone mad. He was always angry mad, a bit wacky perhaps, and he has also recorded the same album for about 30 years running. But as a great poet once said, he's got a new one out now. I don't even know what it's about. But I'll see him in anything, so I'll stand in line. With regard to Dylan, and this being season 3 of the podcast, and it's still the tip of the iceberg, you know, it's nearly impossible to run out of things to say about him. I've written a book about him, too, as you know, about man and God and law. The spiritual wisdom of Bob Dylan is available for purchase right now. So go get it, and we'll continue the conversation in that way, too. And what about Joni Mitchell? She's an unparalleled creative force, a radical personality, a radical artist, a universe unto herself, and she knows it. The Beatles are their own universe, unparalleled. Neil Young has had a run of the table of musical mastery too. Give me Prince or Stevie Wonder, give me Tom Petty. But really, Joni Mitchell and Bob Dylan, they are the ones. And what better way to get into the depths of these two artists and how they intersect than by speaking with David Yaffe, author of Bob Dylan, Like a Complete Unknown, and Reckless Daughter, A Portrait of Joni Mitchell. David is an esteemed and eminently creative music critic and scholar, a professor of humanities at Syracuse University, and his new Substack, Trouble Man, Musings of David Yaffe, is a wonderful, wistful way to journey through pop music and pop culture with a true maven and storyteller. I highly recommend it, and there's a link to the Substack in the show notes wherever you are listening right now. If you haven't stayed up for hours talking about music, your favorite songs and artists, who's the best in a toe-to-toe steel cage death match of a song or a album, or if this obscure ditty or that other one or this bit of gossip or that story that you heard is really true, then you haven't lived. And get a taste of that right now with David. He is the second guest in an incredible lineup of music writers and thinkers who will be joining me this season. More on that at the end of the show. No regrets, Coyote, and I really mean that. We could have talked all night, David and I, about these two transcendent musicians who have shaped our era, how they work, why they work, and what it all means. I'm your host, Stephen Daniel Arnoff. Welcome to Bob Dylan, About Man and God and Law. This is episode 3 of season 3. Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell with David Yaffe.
Hi, Stephen.
Hey, David. Good to see you. So guess what I've been doing today? I've been reading. Guess what I've been reading?
Reckless Daughter.
No, I have read Reckless Daughter, A Portrait of Joni Mitchell, which is a wonderful book that we're going to talk about. I was reading a new Substack by a gentleman by the name of David Yaffe. It's called Trouble Man, Musings of David Yaffe. And I have to ask you that we might actually start by parsing a little bit of a very perfectly timed mention of some of our favorite friends here. Where you write, the songs are my lexicon. And so Dylan says this phrase in an interview.
1997, when Time Out of Mind came out. And it was an interview with David Gates.
Okay, great. So this was an excellent interview with David Gates.
Yeah.
You are citing this phrase, the songs are my lexicon. And you've got two kind of pivots or axes of what you're doing here. More than that, but two that I noticed. The first is you write, looking for answers in the fragment of a song. That's you. And you also...
The fragment of song. I was alluding to a Paul Simon lyric.
Beautiful.
All that remains is the fragment of song. Yeah.
So Paul Simon's in here too. There's a lot of intertextuality going on.
Very fancy word there.
That may be as many syllables as I'm going to pull off in one, you know, utterance. But the second utterance I'm going to note here from you, which you are citing, Northrop Frye, secular scripture. So somewhere in this realm of looking for answers in the fragment of a song, though we now know that's Paul Simon's fragment, and secular scripture, you've already done some musing on these themes and ideas. If you wouldn't mind musing a little bit more about the fragment of a song and secular scripture through the lens, and you can pick, since we're kind of crisscrossing between Joni Mitchell and Bob Dylan, you know, where else would you wander in this musing about the fragment of a song and secular scripture as being essential in some way to each of these artists, each of these philosophers' musical journey?
Well, probably if I knew more about the other arts, I could find it there if I was trained to do so, and if my knowledge was wide enough that I could find that thing. I think that I can find that thing. I can find that thing when I'm looking at a Rothko painting, for example. I can find that thing. I can find that in Rembrandt for sure. Something about the chiaroscuro, is in that arena. I'm just saying it's in the other arts. It's absolutely in literature. It's absolutely in the other arts, but it just happens that I know more about music. And so I'm kind of more attuned to like finding these places of mystery. And this idea that something is going on. And so I'm trying to actually stay in the place where the artist wants to take us, where the artist is aware that there's a mystery there. There's something that can't quite be explained. I think that anytime somebody does something like truly, truly brilliant, you can't quite explain it. And, you know, if you're writing that person's biography, then you look everywhere you can look to tell this person's story and like round it out and flesh it out, make it vivid and make it a cohesive narrative work that people can lose themselves into and all of that. But there's still that element of mystery that you can't explain it. I mean, as you well know, Bob Dylan, I mean, when he drops out of college, he hitchhikes his way to New York City and he's just like a bunch of other people. He's like Ramblin' Jack and all these other people. He's like the mayor of McDougal Street. You know, he's like a lot of people. He's reading the same books. They're all into On the Road. They're all into Bound for Glory. They all have like one model. For some of them, the model is Pete. And for some of them, the model is Woody. And Dylan was one of the Woody people. He wasn't the only Woody person. There were others. And, you know, when he writes songs to Woody, that was basically based on a Woody Guthrie song. I don't think it's a work of genius to make song to Woody, really. It's nice, but it's not, you know, we wouldn't be talking about him if he just stopped at song to Woody. But then suddenly out comes Blowing in the Wind and Hard Rain. And what happened? How did he do that? You know, Dylan is a very documented person. So there are a lot of eyewitnesses to this. People that will tell you, you know, someone was in the room when he wrote Blowing in the Wind and whatever. And even when you're in the room with him and he's writing Blowing in the Wind, you still can't quite figure it out, right? Like what made him what he was. And the same is true with Joni. Obviously, Joni was pent up. Joni had all this stuff that she couldn't talk about. And she was in an unhappy marriage. So she was repressed. And there was this beauty that was in her that came out. But how? She had no training. It wasn't her ambition. Her ambition was to be a painter. Her fallback plan was to do something in the fashion industry. These beautiful songs came out. How? Joni couldn't tell you. It just happened. And I feel like that moment of mystery is where I just think there are things that defy explanation. So whether you have a religious worldview or whether you have an anti-religious view, that mystery is there. And it's there if you're an atheist. It's there if you're a believer. I was in a relationship with a religion scholar, and she was always laying these new ideas on me. She made me question the things that I thought, which was great. And at one point I said something, I said to her, I said, you know, I just think I got something. I said, I think that there is something going on. And she looked me in the eyes and she said, yes, something is going on.
Something's happening here, but you don't know what it is.
And I feel like when the great Hitchens was dying and he was surrounded by all of his distinguished writer friends, Salman Rushdie and Martin Amis and Ian McEwan, that whole crew. And Martin Amis said, I'm slightly to the right of Hitch on God because the majority of the universe is unknown to us. So I still believe in the mystery. And then Hitchens dying is like, oh yes, I believe in the mystery too. And that's where I like to be, you know, and discovering that is such an extraordinary thing. When you know, I've experienced this firsthand. I know that there are people who write songs that are better than they are and that the songs have more wisdom than they have. And I mean, the same thing with Lou Reed. I've spent time with Lou Reed. Very unpleasant guy. Most people report that he's usually pretty unpleasant. I mean, Magic and Loss did so much for me. I mean, it helped me deal with grief, you know? And one of the things that's so powerful about that album is that like you hear this kind of tough guy that's not very emotional and that's not going to comfort you, but he's experiencing grief himself. And somehow having that grief come from that tough guy just makes it more powerful than if it's something sappy, you know?
So, yeah. Well, in your ongoing musings about the musings that you presented in this most recent Substack. So that's the April 19th edition. And it's a daily delivery to our virtual doorsteps, right? You're putting out a piece a day or a piece every other day.
No, I've been doing it too much, but I started it a couple of months ago, and I just counted it, and I have 30 posts.
Okay.
That's kind of crazy.
That's a lot of posts.
That's a lot. I was told to do it
every other day.
There's a guy that's been giving me advice because he has like the number two music Substack. His name is Ted Gioia. I don't know how to pronounce his name.
Okay.
It's spelled G-I-O-I-A.
Okay.
It's an Italian name, I think, or could be a Spanish name. But anyway, he advised me, you know, post at least twice a week and make sure that it's something special. Don't blog. And I took his advice, except that I did it much more often.
So you've got layered into the writing a lot of personal reflection, and there's a lot of feeling, there's a lot of motion. And I wanted to take us back as we think about that particular way of writing about music, I think is maybe unique in some way to rock journalism. In certain ways, there's an element of inserting oneself. Maybe this is creative journalism. Maybe this is just a trend line in journalism more generally. But this insertion of the personal emotion into the experience of the critic, of the writer. You've written two very different books about the artists that we're going to talk about a little bit here. So the Dylan book, Bob Dylan, Like a Complete Unknown, it feels a little bit more like the Substack in the sense that you allow yourself to associate. You have a very clear division and an interesting division of topics or themes that you choose. It's not written in a linear manner. It's thematic and reflective and associative. And you do not shy away from sharing what you can or wish to share about experiencing Dylan. So it is in some sense a personal book, but it travels very far in associating through many, many different elements of Dylan. And you take a look at Dylan through the lens of film, pun intended, musically, obviously, and in lots of ways. The task at hand in writing Reckless Daughter, Portrait of Joni Mitchell, it's the task of a biographer.
Yeah.
So you've got really two different professions at play here, two different jobs. When you reflect back onto each of these books, the biography and the, I think, somewhat historical, textual, analytical, critical Dylan book with a strong personal feel. What would have happened if you had switched the methodology?
Well,
or was it those artists that actually invited those approaches?
You know, I didn't have access to Bob Dylan. Mm-hmm. So I only had access to my Bob Dylan and to other people's Bob Dylan that I found compelling. Whereas with Joni Mitchell, I had access to Joni Mitchell, so I had the responsibility to be her biographer because she hadn't had one. And she had an aneurysm in April of 2015, and she is not the voluble person that she was that I spoke to. Our conversations would sometimes go on for like 12 hours. She's not having those kinds of conversations anymore. And I think her personality has really changed. She's much more gracious now. And I don't think she hates things in the same way. She used to hate everything. And I got this idea. I was just thinking about how, like, when people get older, and especially if, like, they're really, really excellent at what they do, then they kind of start to hate things because they can see the bullshit of most of it. I mean, Joni could really spot a phony note. You know, she compared it to fate coming. You know, Bob Dylan, by the way, even if he was available to me, he wouldn't be very available to me because he doesn't do disclosure anyway. And his interviews are kind of a performance. Joni does this too, but not in the same way that Dylan does it. Dylan is like a different character every time you talk to him. I mean, remember when the first Jan Wenner interview, he does like this is Nashville skyline persona, and like Jan can't break it. He can't get past it. And then I heard a later interview with Jan, and he was just not giving Jan anything. And he was just being very flattering with Jan and just changing the subject.
Did you feel that you needed to break through to Joni Mitchell, or was she primed to do the work? What did it take to get her to really talk? Or do you feel that she really talked?
Oh no, she really talked. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could fill up a whole other book with stuff that I didn't use. She talked so much. But the thing that was the game changer was that she didn't talk to me for years, and I didn't know if she would talk to me again. And then she decided she wanted to start talking to me again. This was in the fall of 2014. I was out with a source, a sculptor named Nathan Joseph. Nathan Joseph was like this very kind of tough Israeli guy, actually. This is kind of macho Israeli guy, and it came from the pioneer generation. And another close friend of Joni's, Malcolm Aron, also Israeli generation. He had a loft on Barrack Street that he rented to Joni. And when Joni just didn't use it for a while, so it was just like left empty. So like one day, Nathan decided to have a party. At the time, he was dating Ellen Barkin, this like super macho sculptor guy, you know, dating Ellen Barkin.
The voice of Theme Time Radio Hour.
Yeah, Nathan Joseph. Yeah, I mean, Nathan Joseph is like he's sort of like Elliot Gould or something, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like very, really tall, very masculine guy. And so Joni shows up when Nathan is having this party, and so first she's pissed off, like, hey, what are you doing having a party? This is my place. But then quickly Joni kicked in and she started to socialize and have fun. And then eventually she turns to Nathan and she kisses him. And he is absolutely terrified. This guy who's dating Ellen Barkin is terrified when she kisses him, because he thought, oh my God, this woman could destroy me. Now, I don't tell this story in the book, but that feeling is the feeling that I really wanted to convey in that book, of being completely overwhelmed by this person. You know, scary what she had, you know. And so they did sleep together for like a year, very casually. They weren't committed to each other. I think he still had Ellen Barkin going on, and she was dating Don Elias, the drummer. When it ended and they just became friends, she was so relieved. I mean, he was relieved. He was relieved that it was over, because she didn't destroy him. And he felt much more calm just being her good friend. And she wrote a song about him called Good Friends. It's the first song on Doggy Dog. So this guy, I was out with this guy and we were just kind of hanging out, having fun. We barely talked about Joni. We just were just hanging out. And we had a delightful time. And I get an email from Nathan a couple of days later, and he said, good news, Joni wants you to call her. And I hadn't talked to her in 6 years. But during those 6 years, I talked to everybody else, about 60 people. So eventually I come out to Los Angeles, and she wanted to know what everybody else said about her. And that became the book. Because she wanted to one up every person's story, because she's a very competitive person. And she also thought that her memory was always better than anybody else's. So like she never, you know, she wanted to fill in the gaps on every story. And so that was the way I got beyond her kind of ranting and focused the ranting on a particular story. Because she would always have something to say. And she wanted to have the last word.
Some fragment, you needed to find a fragment of a story to tie it to.
She said, you're going to get a lot of half-assed stories here, because I kept on changing the subject so that I could get her to talk about everybody. Whereas if she had, it had been her way, she would have talked on and on about one person. Do you know what I mean? And so at one point she said, "You're going to have a lot of half-assed stories here." And I said, "Well, by all means, give me the whole ass."
We have an example of one of these that I didn't know from another one of your stacks, Joni Mitchell's Deepest Cuts. Mm-hmm. So you read to Joni Mitchell, and we spoke recently with Sylvie Simmons, who is Leonard Cohen's biographer, and so it's a nice segue. A poem. Now, this is a poem that Leonard Cohen, did you ask him to share something with you that you could share with Joni?
Well, I had talked to Leonard. I had this incredible experience with Leonard the night before my final interview with Joni. And he wanted to show me that poem. So he sent me an email with that poem in it.
So I'll read it so we can hear it. Master poet, master painter, most subtle technician of the deep, you are indeed queen undisputed of mind beauty, star-breasted, disguised as a ravishing piece. You change the way women sing and the way men listen. What an astonishing victory over the unforgiving years. And you read it to her.
I did.
And she responded in kind.
Well, it was interesting because she was used to trashing him. You know, and she'd been trashing him for years.
Leonard Cohen, she was trashing.
Yes, yes. Yeah, she thought he was a phony Buddhist. And she just thought every song he writes has the phrase naked body. Yeah. It's like, you know, like she was like, oh, he's always about conquest. You know, like first we take Manhattan, like everything's a conquest for him. But everything about that melted because... And I had talked to Leonard about what a hard time she, because she was giving me a very hard time that week, actually. I was lucky to get that interview at the end of that week because she was giving me a very hard time. And she was in a bad mood, which is a whole other story, which I can tell you, but it's a whole other story. He said to me, he said, "Joni doesn't seem well disposed to me. I don't know why." And then he said, "But could you tell her that I would love to see her and we could meet in her beautiful home or we could meet at my home or at another place of her choosing. And if not, that's okay too, because love is eternal." So I conveyed that message. And she, all of the negative stuff that she had prepared to say about Leonard just completely melted away. Mm. And she told me to give him her number. And even the best times of day to call, because her times of day were kind of unusual.
Right.
I realized, by the way, that the best time of day to get her was about 2 o'clock p.m. Pacific time. And I had been in the habit of calling her at like 5. But 2 is better, because if you got her at 2, then nothing bad has happened yet. 5, it's likely that something bad has happened and it puts her in a bad mood.
It means that she was just so extremely sensitive to everything that was happening around her, and her protection was a kind of fury, a kind of anger.
Just, yes, things pissed her off, and they were often related to money and just... For example, the reason why she was in such a bad mood that week that I had that final interview with her was because, as you know, Joni's put out these archives now. She's put out 2 volumes of the Joni Mitchell archives. But and she was under contract to do that way earlier. And she wanted to compete with Dylan's bootleg series.
Right.
She thought, hey, if you can do that, I want to do that. And she decided she just didn't want to look at the past. She found it painful. And so she wanted to just shut the whole thing down. And there was the matter of that there's a guy named Joel Bernstein. Do you know who that is?
I know the name, yeah.
Joel Bernstein, you know, like kind of part of the Dylan CSNY crowd. And
he was involved also with Theme Time Radio Hour, I think, Joel Bernstein. Yeah.
And he took the cover photo of For the Roses.
Uh-huh.
And he did the skating shots for the open the inside of the Hejira cover. Not Norman Seeff did the cover, but he did the skating shots. Joel Bernstein was to be paid $50,000 as a consultant on this project. And since Joni decided to kill the project, she would have to pay him $50,000. And that put her in a really bad mood.
You know, comparing the sort of the legacy making, the archiving, machinery that Dylan's team has created over the years is incredible. They've saved everything. They have captured just about every kind of media. There's the Bob Dylan Center. There's the bootleg series alone is just this massive capturing of public consciousness. The legend of Dylan is held incredibly tightly and skillfully by Jeff Rosen and company. Is Joni Mitchell essentially operating solo? Does she have that kind of machine, though, that really is legacy making? I mean, she's been very public, obviously, just in this past month, right? There's been a real public reemergence.
Amazing time to be Joni Mitchell, and amazing. I think that it's given her a great boost of energy, and I could see when she like strutted to the stage of the Grammys. She, you know, her physical therapist was there with her, but still I could tell she was in a good mood.
Yeah.
That was lovely. But I mean she's got this manager, Frank Girondo, and this woman that's assisting with her. I mean, she's got like a little bit of a team around her, but it's nothing like that. But I think it's a different kind of project, because the thing that makes it similar is that many of us who are devoted to Joni, we have some sense of amazing archival stuff that hasn't been released and should be, and should have the sound cleaned up. And one remarkable thing that was done was the new master of Song to a Seagull. The mastering got botched on the original record, and Joni was like so pissed off about it, because David Crosby didn't know how to produce an album.
You mentioned this in this piece that we just mentioned. Yeah,
he did not know how to produce an album. He knew how to do other things, but he didn't know how to do that. And I mean, I think he knew how to produce an album in the sense that like he knew how to get a great performance. Although Joni didn't really think so. She thought that he would miss the best takes. She didn't think he was even good at that. but I would probably give him that, because it's such a beautiful record to me. It sounds very well produced, except for this mastering issue, where what happened was he left the he wanted the overtones of the grand piano to be captured, and so there was too much of a signal to noise, and it produced a hiss, and so it doesn't sound like it was recorded the year that it was. It sounds like something that was recorded decades earlier. You know, it's sort of like you're listening to a record from the 40s or something. Which I do listen to records that were recorded in the 40s, so it's fine. But you know, I know that it should have better quality. So when they fix the remastering, it's beautiful. It's like, I mean, it's not perfect, but it's as good as it could possibly be, and it's way better than I ever thought it would be. So that was an archival miracle that they fixed that. But for example, I've heard the demos from Hissing of Summer Lawns, which, by the way, you can hear on YouTube, and they're just remarkable.
Mm.
They are so extraordinary. And before they were available on YouTube, I had them on discs. And I remember David Haidu used to teach at Syracuse. And I remember going to his office and I said, you've got to hear this. And it was the acoustic demo of Harry's House. It was either that or In France They Kiss on Main Street. I think it started with In France They Kiss on Main Street, actually. And it was like the demo, and it's her harmonizing with herself and her like double tracking the guitar. And it was just extraordinary. And I could, he said, he heard it and he said, oh my God. He said, this is why we do this.
You know, that's a perfect segue for two fragments I picked up in what you were just saying. David Hayju, who I think wrote Positively 4th Street, right?
Yes.
And of course, that's the tune that Joni Mitchell cites as kind of a door opening tune for her in understanding Dylan's ability to bring to the fore of popular music wrath of a certain kind. It sounds like there's a level of rage, wrath, anger, some sharp-edged emotions when you're describing Joni Mitchell's persona. So I'm curious your reflections on that. But you also mentioned, and I had not heard this before, when I have heard Joni Mitchell calling someone a fake, I always assume she's talking about Bob Dylan. To call Leonard Cohen a fake, my goodness, that's the far edge. But somewhere between the fake and the wrath, somewhere between 4th Street and you know, Leonard Cohen's little half apartment. I don't know, reflections on Joni's wrath, Dylan, the fakery.
Well, that's a big subject. I would start big with subject. Saying that. So the thing that blew her away when she first heard Positively 4th Street was that you had this kind of conversational confrontation. Mm-hmm. And she had no idea that you could put that into a song. You know, it just didn't even occur to her that you could put something like that into a song. And then she thought, my God, if you can do that, you can do anything. It was, and because she was in the folk scene, right? In a very minor way at that point. This was really her, 65 was her first year as a songwriter, really. I mean, she'd written one song called Day After Day in 64. But in the 65, she writes Urge for Going and a couple of other things. But Urge for Going was the one that, you know, it was a minor Canadian, it was a minor country hit by a guy named George Hamilton IV. And it was a song that she recorded eventually. And it's on the Hits and Misses. She recorded it during the Blues Sessions, actually. And then it was released as a B-side. But anyway, so here she was, just like, didn't expect to be a star at this point, 1965, just kind of starting out and doing the things that you can hear on volume one of the Joni Mitchell archives, doing Nancy Whiskey and things like that, and imitating Baez, imitating Judy Collins, because they were the people to imitate. And then she ended up not liking them personally, but they were the first exemplars. When she heard that, okay, first of all, since she didn't like people being imitators, she was immediately suspicious of Dylan because she thought that he was a Woody Guthrie imitator. So she didn't think his singing was interesting. I don't know how she could have missed the writing, but she just didn't think he was interesting because she thought it was derivative. But as soon as she heard that song, first of all, it sounded nothing like Woody Guthrie. And she could tell that it was something that was original and startling. But then Joni still had a quest for beauty. And Joni had a beautiful voice, which Dylan did not have. And Joni's exemplars, going back before Baez and Collins, were, you know, Billie Holiday and Bing Crosby and just the whole Great American Songbook. And so she wanted to take that personal confrontational style, not always confrontational, sometimes other, all of the multitudes that could be part of a conversation. She wanted to take that and make it beautiful, you know, because she thought that this thing that was startling to her was at the expense of music. So she wanted to have that, but then make it more like the Great American Songbook.
What do you mean at the expense of music?
She thought, because it was like, it was almost like hip hop or something. It was conversational. So I don't know if there's a beautiful way. I think that it would be kind of like comical if to try to make it beautiful. I mean, if you could imagine what Bing Crosby would have sounded like singing Positively 4th Street, it sounds like, you know, an SCTV routine or something, you know.
She must have loved Dylan Sinatra albums.
I know, that's exactly. That's full circle. It's really full circle, isn't it? But yeah. I mean, you know, the thing is, okay, this is what I mean. Bing Crosby sang Both Sides Now. Frank Sinatra sang Both Sides Now, right? Now, I suppose they could have sung Blown in the Wind. It would have been pretty corny, but I suppose they could have done, or, you know, a Dylan song that I think could be covered by a lot of people very beautiful is Tomorrow is a Long Time.
Sure.
Because Elvis Presley did that.
Elvis did it. Rod Stewart did it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah. But I mean, oh, you know who has a beautiful Tomorrow is a Long Time is Nick Drake.
Really?
Yeah. And he didn't release it, but it's on a box set. It's like on a demo. Okay. Beautiful, beautiful. But anyways, there's certain Dylan songs where you can imagine where they are beautifully covered, obviously many, many, many. But that particular song, I think the whole point of it is that it's meant to be kind of ugly, and that if you're not making it ugly, it's not in the spirit of the song. It's supposed to be hostile. And that was what kind of shook her up, that you could even do that, you know? And obviously, like, when Joni got older and her voice changed, her singing became more Dylan-like in a way. Sure. But she didn't see that coming. This is young Joni, when she just had the voice that she had then. And then her idea was, how do I make something beautiful with this?
Was there a point just on the voice? I've thought about this regarding Dylan as well, just with the cigarettes, right? Mm-hmm. Where she really knew, if I don't do something to manage this now, I am going to lose 2.5 octaves, you know, within a certain amount of time. My instrument will be gone. I will need another instrument. Mm-hmm. I don't know, you know, Dylan, legend has it, had the Lay Lady Lay, right? That was supposedly the time where he stopped smoking for 10 minutes.
Right.
Did she talk to you about that, about the smoking and the voice?
Yes, but it was all delusional, because she had this idea that she had vocal nodes, and that it was the vocal nodes that caused her voice to change, not the cigarettes. Uh-huh. But when Larry Klein told me that Joni tried to quit smoking at various times when they were married, and she became so impossible that he just said, please start smoking again. Because it was just, and by the way, at one point she got pregnant and she wouldn't stop smoking when she was pregnant. Mm. 42 years old, having a high risk pregnancy, and she would not stop smoking or anything else.
But no reflection on that. I mean, just a heavy, heavy addiction that really there was no daylight between that and any other realities.
I don't think so. And I think that she was going to embrace sounding more like, you know, Billie Holiday on Lady in Satin or something.
Right.
And which is exactly what happened.
Right.
And she's also just, I don't know about now, but when she was in that period of her life, she was always thinking about what was happening, you know, like she was just, for example, when we talked about the Mingus album, I asked her if she was a little daunted by the fact that she like was having to be a quick study, because she didn't really know that much about Mingus, to capture him, to capture his character, to capture his story. And to set to put lyrics to his final melodies, you know, while he was dying of Lou Gehrig. And she said, oh, no, because I only think about what's happening. I didn't think about that. I think about what's happening.
And what does that mean? I only think about what's happening.
I think she just meant, I've got this song to write. Uh-huh. I have a job, you know, and I'm experiencing everything. I'm getting to know this person. I'm getting to love this person. Uh-huh. You know, she loved his whole spirit. She loved everything about him. And she wanted to tell a story and she wanted to get it right. But I mean, the thing I meant was that, like, this is within a few months, he would lose the ability to speak. That's really what I meant, that there was times weighing a chariot going on there. And for most people, it would be hard to not be aware of it.
Mm. So yeah, you know, this this Tower of Song here. These three who were born with the golden voice, Leonard Cohen, Joni Mitchell, and Bob Dylan. Do you see them as three separate branches of song in the three separate floors in the Tower of Song, with Hank Williams, you know, hacking on another floor? Can you imagine any of them existing without the other? Where are the areas of influence, or in fact, are they just sort of bringing in endless amounts of content to become whoever they would be as musicians, as poets, as performers? Are they archetypal?
I would say that they all represent song as literature. You could have a beautiful song with mediocre lyrics. And if the beauty of the song compels you, or if the power of it compels you, then you can enjoy it. But then you know that you're hearing placeholders, but they're kind of fun because the song is fun and you're enjoying it. And a great melodist could get away with murder and have mediocre lyrics. It happens all the time. Whereas you seldom have great lyrics in the absence of hooks. You seldom have that. I guess, you know, in a way hip hop is that, but that's, I'll just put that as a separate idea. Mm-hmm. But I think, and of course Dylan, funny thing about Dylan is that, like, there are like songs that are very cliched, but then people sort of enjoy it. I mean, I guess I feel like I'm part of the cult of Dylan, so that like I can enjoy like Wiggle Wiggle or something. Like, it's still kind of amusing to me that Bob Dylan wrote that. Or, you know, If Dogs Run Free, Why Not We, or something, you know. I mean, it's not like everything he did was brilliant. But to me, actually, like, having those, the weaker songs just make everything more interesting to me, because it's like, it's the figure in the carpet or something. But I mean, but obviously at their very best, and this is what Salvation must be like after a while. That's kind of, you know, Inside the Museum's Infinity Goes Up on Trial, Voices Echo, This is what Salvation must be like after a while. I mean, that's it, right? I mean, this music will last. It will outlast us. I mean, unless, you know, a totalitarian state kind of takes over and eliminates music, or only for state purposes. If America becomes North Korea, then we could lose all of this. But
or another record company warehouse goes up in smoke, plus, right?
After the universal fire, like we discussed. But while we have it, and hopefully, you know, like after we're gone, other people will have it, we hope, that it's something that outlasts its listener. It's something that surpasses utterance. You know, when I would teach literature, I would tell students that the literature is language that surpasses utterance. In other words,
it surpasses utterance.
Yes. In other words, most of what is said serves a function, and then it is disposable. You say pass the mustard, you get the mustard, and now pass the mustard is over.
Okay.
If you have your mustard and then you still say you want mustard, there's something wrong with you.
Yeah.
Because that served its function and it's over. But, you know, I am a man more sinned against than sinning. That surpasses utterance. There's nothing you can say to that to make that obsolete. Although people try, they can't. And that Rembrandt at the Frick will keep staring at you after. You can't outlast it. You can try staring back at it, but you will lose. The Rembrandt will win. And Dylan songs are like that. Leonard songs are like that. Joni songs are like that. It is remarkable that you have this medium that is meant to be entertainment, and that's something that is really on the level of great literature, is also entertainment. Because, you know, in poetry, if you're writing for the page, there are no placeholders. The whole thing has to be legit. You're not leaning on music. You're not leaning on anything. Right. Like, you have to create your own music, and you have to, and it has to be every single syllable has to be justified. But obviously with music, you have placeholders all the time. And it's so much easier to teach this stuff than it used to be because of streaming, mm-hmm. and because of YouTube, and especially YouTube Premium, no ads. Okay. You know, at Sarah Lawrence, I taught a class called Representing Jazz, and I would have like VHS tapes with me queued up. That was 20 years ago.
Sure.
So, but now you don't have to do that. Now everything's on YouTube, and you can teach this stuff. It's great to be able to do that. You know, like you mentioned Elvis Costello. I mean, obviously, everything he does is on such an extraordinary level. And he read Reckless Daughter. I was really pleased because I was going to send him a book, but he'd already read it.
And
he loved it. It was, he kept on, like whenever Joni's name would come up, he'd say, well, but you know more than I do. But then he would tell me something.
Well, that musicality is incredible musicality, you know. Another triple threat.
Yes. Not everybody loves The Voice, but I do.
Well, it's so signature also.
Oh my God. And the musical. Now that guy really has no placeholders.
Right.
That guy, those lyrics are unbelievable. And, the song Almost Blue, what an extraordinary song. He was so young when he wrote it. And that whole story, you know, the whole story about Elvis and Chet Baker?
No.
So that song was inspired by Chet Baker singing The Thrill Is Gone. Uh-huh. That was sort of the basis of that song. And so Elvis was recording Punch the Clock, and he wrote the song with Clive Langer, Shipbuilding.
Oh, yeah.
And
sounds like your Elvis Costello meter is going off.
I know, it's the Elvis Costello alarm.
Or the Chet Baker alarm. We don't know.
Is the place going to burn down? Or are you okay? Okay. All right, but no fire. Fire bad.
Fire bad.
Fire good, fire bad.
I'm glad that we get to see you handling a crisis.
I see.
Yeah, that was solid. Yeah.
I know. Yes. Oh, so Elvis wanted Chet Baker to play this trumpet solo on it. And so he was at Ronnie's. Elvis went to see him at Ronnie's. And it's an amazing thing. You go to a jazz club and like, it's very easy to talk to the musicians. They're very accessible. You know, it's not like going to a rock concert. And so like Chet was just like at the bar hanging out, and Elvis introduced himself to him. Elvis had no idea who he was. And he said, listen, we're recording tomorrow and we'd love it if you could play a solo on this track. And Chet said, do you pay scale? And Elvis said, I think we can do better than that. Do you pay cash? Chet said, do you pay cash?
Yeah.
And Elvis knew what that meant.
Yeah.
What that was for. He said, yes. And Elvis, Chet comes in, he nails it in one take. Yeah. He gets his cash. And then Chet said, Elvis said, listen, I wrote this song inspired by you, and I would love it if you could like listen to it, and I just want you to have it.
Yeah.
So Chet started performing it, actually, and Elvis really? Didn't know. Yeah, there are many recordings of him performing in the late 80s. And so there was this documentary that Bruce Weber made about him called Let's Get Lost, mm-hmm. and Elvis died. I mean, but Chet died in the middle of filming. And so it became a much more raw, honest documentary because of that. And at the beginning of the film, you hear him trying to quiet down a crowd so that he can sing Almost Blue. Hmm. And Elvis is at a screening room seeing this after Chet has died. That's how he learned that Chet had done the song. And talking to Elvis was really something, because I would get interrupted a lot. I would get cut off a lot. He talked a lot. And so I couldn't get everything in, but the thing I wanted to mention about it was there's a line in Elvis's song Almost Blue, it's almost touching, it will almost do, which is like kind of English, ironic. Chet sings almost blue, almost touching, it will almost do. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
It's like a wound.
Yeah. That's like, that's the fragment of a song.
Yes. And I think I don't think that he set out to recreate the lyric. I just think that's how he heard it and that's how he sang it.
Yeah.
But that to me is like, whoa. And I wanted to know what Elvis thought of it. And I just couldn't.
So I wanna circle back a little bit to the lexicon idea. Mm-hmm. And really it's a question. Similar to the one that I asked Sylvie Simmons, you know, like yourself, has quite an incredible repertoire of artists that she's engaged with in interviews or written about, gotten to know. And at one point she described herself as Leonard Cohen's handmaid, in the sense that she brought to the world what she felt had not been written about him in terms of being able to describe him. And obviously you've had a an opportunity from which we all benefit to have a deeply researched, deeply felt biography of Joni Mitchell. You're now writing, well, you're writing at a pace of one piece every two or three days.
Yeah.
You write about a lot of different things. You've written about a lot of different kinds of music.
Yeah.
Most of this is, in the realm of rock and roll, blues, bit of jazz. I mean, you've written extensively about jazz, obviously. What is your job going forward as a writer, as a thinker, particularly about music, and particularly at a moment where, these artists, Leonard Cohen, Paul Simon, Bob Dylan, Leonard Cohen obviously is gone. These absolute titans. What is the role of the person who not only feels the music deeply, but has a platform and is using a platform to write? What is the role of the rock journalist critic going forward?
Well, I was lucky that I got to talk to Leonard. I was lucky that I spent as much time as I did with Joni, and I was lucky that I got to talk to Paul Simon. I was fascinated at the way his mind worked. And in the case of Paul Simon, he just shows you what he does.
Yeah.
Bob Dylan doesn't do that.
Paul Simon pulls out the legal pad and shows you piece by piece. Although the Dylan book that's coming, he's going to show us how everybody else does it, apparently.
Right.
The book,
Yes, that's right. That's very interesting too. That's interesting that he's interested in other people like that. And I believe Elvis is one of those songwriters he's going to talk about. Paul Simon was a guy that was briefly enrolled in law school. And so he has this logical mind, and he's not afraid of just showing you what it is. It's not this daimonic threshold that he's afraid to cross, which
doesn't seem to take away the magic of the process for him.
It makes it more magical, really, because he just exactly shows you what he does. If you've seen that thing with Dick Cavett, there are two interviews with Dick Cavett, one where he talks about how he made Bridge Over Troubled Water, and then another one where he's stuck on the second verse of Still Crazy. He doesn't have a bridge, and he doesn't have the third verse, and he doesn't know what to do.
Right.
And just catching him at that moment, you really see him in the middle of something. You see his mind working, and you see, okay, these are the number of keys that I haven't used, and I could either go here or here, but then lyrically, he has no idea where he's going to go.
Right.
But anyway, it's true that just as I would, get to know somebody who had talked to Charlie Parker, you know what I mean? And like the idea of access to Charlie Parker is like having access to Shakespeare or something.
Right.
It's like, and so, yes, if I live long enough, then people will, I hope, will be amazed that I talk to these people. So I guess I'm interested in how music works in the head and how it works and the emotions. And then I want to create something beautiful that make people feel something.
the writing element really matters to you, though. I mean, you really, yeah, you put the time in to write beautifully. You are interested in creating something that's poetic. I mean, this comes out, I think, because it's possible for it to come out much more in the Dylan book, in Bob Dylan, Like a Complete Unknown, because, you know, the framing is allows for more of that than a biography would. Mm-hmm. And so now, I'm guessing that, for those who want to get a taste with Trouble Man Musings of David Yaffe, just go to Substack, and you are easy to find there. That's Yaffe on the last name. Yaffe, which comes from the Hebrew for Yaffe, of course, or beautiful.
It's a rabbinical.
Is there a bigger project brewing? Is there a bigger project brewing in the musings?
I had thought that I did have a memoir brewing, but I'm going to have to put that aside. And not sure. I mean, I've got I'm writing a couple of things for The Guardian, and I'm writing for Airmail.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a screenplay that I'm going to be working on. I don't know if in the current publishing climate, if I could have even sold Reckless Daughter, being a straight man, mansplaining Joni Mitchell. And so I just have to explore like what's possible. And I've heard things like, well, the only music book that you could sell would be an As Told To by a famous person.
Right.
You know, but I'm still exploring what else is possible. Publishing has become kind of narrow.
Yeah.
And I see it when I get the catalogs, you know, I'm like, really? So it's just a matter of like finding like the right thing, or like just waiting for like the rules to change again, because they always do change. What people say is possible now won't be true in 6 months.
Hmm.
I mean, I would be interested in collecting some of these Substack pieces to a collection of essays, but then revising them to be a book. I mean, not just in the same format that they are in Substack, but
I want to encourage people to ride along with you. And I do think it's really quite a honor and privilege that you had bestowed upon you by the rock gods, those who determine who shall biograph and who shall not, who by fire and who by water.
Well, I mean, I went through a lot with Joni. I went through a lot with Joni, you know. It was, I mean, I couldn't imagine, I guess it could, but it's difficult to imagine doing something exactly like that, because the whole thing was a tightrope.
Yeah.
You know, and it was a miracle that it worked out the way it did, because it was difficult being treated that way by someone that you admire so much.
Yeah.
You know, and of course it never changed my admiring her.
Well, as a great poet once said, you've got a lot of nerve.
Yes.
To say you are my friend.
Yes, yes. Yes.
So I will say to you, my friend, I want to thank you for the time. We've spoken a couple of times now, and it's been a real pleasure. Look forward to staying in touch.
Please.
And seeing what is going to be in my inbox tomorrow morning.
Yeah, my next post is going to be about bad music.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Well,
that's good news about the bad news.
It's like, how do you know when something is bad?
I have been waiting for a post like that to come into my life. How's that?
Like, you know, is there like an a priori definition of bad music? Is it subjective? Is it because you have a bad association with it? Or is it just bad and you can't get away from it? And its badness is just so... It's not about like preferring something to another thing, but it's just like the badness itself is so all-encompassing. If you don't acknowledge the badness, then you can't really define the greatness.
Mm.
And it's possible that somebody that you think is great has also done something bad.
Mm.
And I mean, for example, like Arthur Baker did not do Dylan a great service on the way that Empire Burlesque sounded, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jeff Rosen did a remarkable service by having that bootleg series so that you could hear those songs without the production. And they're so good, obviously. They're very good. But I mean, it's just Various Positions has some amazing songs on it, but I don't love the production of that record. And when, and in fact, I prefer the live versions of those songs.
That's going to be a teaser. If you can do all that in 1500 words or less, we will be back for more.
I really want to talk about Michael Bolton. I know the guy who's responsible for him being in the music business. Uh-huh. And he said to me, you wouldn't believe how good his demo was. And so I'm going to see if it's on YouTube. I'm going to bite the bullet and see what his demo sounded like and see if that's true. Maybe there was a little bit of good in that guy.
The parable shall be explained.
Yes.
We'll see. That's a teaser.
That's a teaser.
That's a teaser.
Hasn't been written yet. So
Season 2.
I'm like Paul Simon, stuck on the second verse. I'm still crazy after all these years.
Well, if I have done anything today, may I merit to be your Dick Cavett as you seek.
It's an honor. Yes. I talk to him too.
We'll look forward to that story another time, but yes. I just hope that, he was revealed as revealing as he was in those great, great interviews. Cause everyone, those were amazing.
Amazing
rock and roll interviews. He really is an icon.
I interviewed him twice, and the first time he was a little spotty on his memory, but then he wanted to reschedule and he consulted with his producer and got the notes from the show, but from the Woodstock show. And then he was interviewing me.
Yeah. Well, he knows how to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. It was extraordinary. Yeah.
Right on. All the best to you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
This has been episode 3 of season 3 of Bob Dylan About Man and God and Law. Visit mangodlaw.com for events, episodes, and more about the book About Man and God and Law, The Spiritual Wisdom of Bob Dylan. It is indeed now available wherever books are sold. I'll be in Jerusalem, New York, Columbus, Cleveland, Mansfield, and LA in the month of May. Come find me and say hello. Next up, an incredible conversation with Scott Wormuth. If you have not heard about Scott's work, please Google it now and discover what might be the most interesting and the most simple explanation for how Bob Dylan works today. We had such a wonderful conversation. I'm looking forward to sharing it with you in 2 weeks. We are proud to be part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Check out all of the stellar podcasts for music lovers at pantheonpodcasts.com. And did I mention the book? The book, yes. I'm fired up. Find About Man and God and Law, The Spiritual Wisdom of Bob Dylan, wherever fine books are sold. I'm also, and still, your host, Dr. Stephen Daniel Arnoff. Thank you so much for coming, and see you soon.
Surprised. You say, how are you? Good luck, but you don't mean it.